This podcast is brought to you by the Legarten Institute. I'm Sian Hansen, Executive Director, and we hope you enjoy this conversation.
I'm Howell Williams. I'm Senior Advisor at the Legarten Institute, and I'm here this evening talking to Martin Brack of the University of Utrecht, who's come to deliver the third of this year's History of Capitalism lectures. And this one is on what used to be called the Dutch Golden Age.
It was called the Dutch Golden Age.
And one of those periods in the history of a nation when everything apparently comes together and it's terrifically tickety-boo and success breeds on success in all sorts of areas. The economy is pretty basic to this pattern of success. What was happening to the Dutch economy in the 17th century that made it so successful, Martin?
Well, I think the most important and most obvious aspect of it is that it went global. I mean, this was a process that was happening in Europe already in the preceding centuries, but not on quite the same scale as it was during the 17th century. And of course, it continued to go global in the 18th and 19th centuries, and then in our own days. But this is, well, I mean, this is still an issue that historians very much debate, but a lot of people would say this is the first global age. And that had an impact on the Dutch economy in a number of ways, but most obviously in terms of its trade volume, but on top of that also in terms of shipping, then of course in terms of shipbuilding industry. So there were all these knock-on effects.
Hmm. Now, areas such as Flanders to the south and the what came to be called the United Provinces at a later stage, had been home to very high quality manufacturers since the late Middle Ages. So what is new in the 17th century is the scale of the enterprise.
Yes, that's, and so in terms of globalization, but also in terms of domestic markets, for example. So one of the things that people are increasingly saying is that, in some ways, of course, Renaissance Italy was already becoming a consumer society, but you see a much deeper penetration of consumer products into society in 17th century.
Now, it's an age of great economic enterprise, of very great wealth. And a lot of this wealth is spent on the arts. This was a very, it seems to me, self-conscious society, very aware of itself, liked to think about why it was successful and what it was getting right. What are the other kind of leading features of the intellectual life of the Republic and its relationship to the economy? I mean, were people really, really aware of how astonishing this thing was that it happened to them?
Well, not perhaps quite to the extent that we are nowadays, because of course we have the advantage of hindsight. But yes, people were aware, and actually the word Golden Age was, intermittently, but people talked about their own era as an extraordinary period. To that extent, a lot of people were also reacting to what was happening in terms of the arts, intellectually, but not so much in terms of its economic success as such, but in terms of the new society that this economy was creating. So the idea that there was the first age of bourgeois dominance, if you will, the idea that civic culture was somehow crucial to this whole success, as you can see, for instance, in Rembrandt's Night Watch, the whole idea that these middle-class men, because they were mainly men, were in a way celebrating their success, but also showing to the world what a special society they were.
It's a remarkable thing, it seems to me, this creation of the Dutch Republic as an association of states. It's a federation. Yes. Now, federations, politically speaking, are ancient. You know, the Greeks had federations. Romans had forms of federations. But it was a pretty novel thing in the life of Western Europe in the early modern period to have that degree of integration of these, you know, these previous provinces. Of course, much later on in the United States, we have the revival of the idea of the federation there in a very, very, very big way. Nation building is become rather, you know, contemporary cliche, isn't it? But were the Dutch themselves aware of the fact that that's what they were doing, that they were inventing a nation or at least new national institutions?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. So there was, I mean, the federal structure is basically a political way of creating the nation. Yes, they talk about the fatherland. They see themselves as patriots in all, and not necessarily of their own town or village, but of the country as a whole. And there is a whole imagery, but also a very conscious creation of a new language carved out from, let's say, its German origins. That all contributes to this idea that the Netherlands are something peculiar in the world, if you will, and also something special in the world. So one of the ideas that they have is that the Netherlands are the second Israel, and have that God has something special in mind with the Dutch.
And in the 17th century, it was still quite an unusual thing for something very new to be regarded as somehow very good. Because, you know, the cult of antiquity
is
still
very
widespread,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, but of course this is something that the Dutch too appeal to. So there, the whole argument in the 17th century is actually that the Dutch Republic is, in a way, going back to its Batavian roots. So it's not at all something new. And actually, in the political science lectures at Leiden University in the 17th century, for a very long time, the professors praise monarchy as the best form of government. So they are, on the one hand, proud of, but also slightly shy of the novelty of their creation.
Well, this is where I think our King William III is rather interesting, because there's a tendency to think, in certain kind of, you know, liberal, old-fashioned Whiggish historiography of William as a, you know, great liberal and glorious revolution and all of that.
Yeah.
But he's none of that, is he? In Holland, he represents a real reaction against the downgrading of the powers of the Stadtholder.
Yeah, but I think that it is still important that he took his Dutch experience of coming to terms with, let's say, the people's representatives as something that he knew could work. And so in that sense, his compromise with Parliament has a very strong Dutch element to it, even though in the Dutch context, he was felt as relatively authoritarian, if you will. But by the standards of almost any country, he was much less powerful in a very formal way, but also somebody who had tried first to rule against the States General, discovered that it didn't work, then decided to throw his luck or to join up with the States General, and that worked.
Well, he decides, essentially, to go with the grain of the political institutions he's got, rather than sort of going against it in a kind of monarchical revolutionary way. And that's what makes him an interesting English king as well. And his English experiences, I mean, of course, very we tend to think of them as very important. But I think it was always really the Dutch experience that was the really important thing for William III. Mm. I mean, he wanted England. Yeah. He wanted to be king of England, so you get English soldiers to fight.
Yeah, no. That's probably true, although I'm not sure if it was still like that at the very end of his life. But initially, the whole thing was planned and executed with the interests of the Dutch in mind rather than the English in mind, although he probably would have argued that they were both strategically in the same boat anyway, because if Louis XIV had managed to dominate the continent, it also would have impacted on British interests or English interests very much. So in that sense, I don't think he felt that these two things were, as it were...
His interpretation has enjoyed a very long period of success, hasn't it? This notion of the Protestant International and the idea of Louis XIV as a wicked French king determined to establish some kind of odd natural border and a kind of incipient Napoleonic figure. Louis XIV comes out of this kind of very badly. But he's central to the Whig tradition in English historiography, of course, isn't he, as well?
Yeah, but I'm not sure if he... the idea, I think, behind this is that Louis XIV did what French kings were supposed to do and were able to do once the Holy Roman Empire, as it were, collapsed under the weight of its own domestic infighting. So I'm not sure if it's seen as a personal thing, but this is how the continent strategically was set up. And once that balance between Habsburg and Valois had collapsed, this was only natural. And so what William is trying to do is create a new countervailing power by combining the English and Dutch interests. And in a way, it worked like that for quite some time.
Quite a long time. Well, it's one of the great founding myths of English history that 1066 is supposed to have been the last invasion of the island of Britain, and of course it wasn't. There was an important Dutch invasion in December 1688. And we're looking forward very much to finding out about all of these things with you, Martin, later on this evening.
Thank you very much.
To hear more podcasts from the Legatum Institute, please visit our iTunes channel or website at www.li.com.